K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the TechNet on Limehawk, as we've done for the last 35 and a fraction years. TechNet began in September of 1982, and this will be TechNet number 1,677 of the series. Meets every Sunday night for approximately 4 hours, if there's enough enthusiasm for it, 8 o'clock till midnight. The main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who want to have more discussions about wireless equipment in general, any subject of interest to radio amateurs. And inside of every radio amateur, in my opinion, is a scientist trying to get out, and they like investigating all kinds of things, but in particular, antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and the various kinds of propagation. And there's something like 25 or 27 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 27 kinds. Let me drop. Arguably, if you don't find complete pleasure, so to speak, with this particular branch of ham radio, try one of the other 26 kinds before you give up the hobby. I think it's about the most educational hobby that a person can enter into. Ham radio operators really like to communicate. They talk to each other and pick each other's brain and say, I tried this and it didn't work, and I tried that and it worked better, and lots of information just passed back and forth. The TechNet itself is whether or not it's interesting or not. It's primarily a function of whether or not you ask questions that become interesting. For the most part, we don't plan what gets discussed. The people who sign in with questions are what determines what gets discussed each Sunday night. Let me drop. But over the years, it has slowly developed into a number of individual sections. In the beginning, people sign in with their questions and or comments. Then we follow it with the science or physics section, led by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. That in turn is followed by the space report by Paul W. S2N. And he tells us what NASA and all the other space agencies are doing. Too bad right now that we're missing 60 Minutes, because one of the subjects on 60 Minutes tonight, their second subject, happens to be the Voyager spacecraft, which I guess is in its, 1977. I think this is its 40th year, and it's just reached 13 billion miles. And so 60 Minutes on CBS television is the second subject is Voyager. One of my favorite subjects. I always ask Paul, what's Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 doing these days? How far are they and what are they saying? Can you imagine that a spacecraft made by human beings, let me drop, is so far away that at the speed of light it takes roughly 18 hours for the signal to get up to Voyager. And when Voyager answers you, another 18 hours for the signal to come back. 18 and a half, something like that. Something like 37 hours round trip time for the two sides of the conversation at the speed of light. That's really down the road a piece. I think it's 130 astronomical units, three times the distance of Pluto, and traveling is where Voyager is, way out there. It has left the solar system, so and it's still working after all these years. It's able to take its a roughly 2-degree antenna, I think it is, 2-degree beam with antenna, aim it very precisely at the Earth. The signal going one way to Voyager or back experiences, I think the number is 310 dB of loss. That's about the biggest amount of loss you've ever considered. Let me drop. Andy, the B2CDL, told me that quite possibly during the session tonight, we're going to hear from Bob. As you know, Andy is doing some work with the New York City subway, investigating an interesting problem that is being investigated, and to find out what's really going on, to give mysterious readings on an ohmmeter that's trying to measure the integrity of grounding of a cabinet, multiple cabinets in multiple stations. Okay, a person signs into the TechNet by giving this group of people your call letters, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening, you don't have to sign in. We no longer need it to be proven to us that the TechNet is being listened to. After 35 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. It probably is a record of the number of hours of TechNet, over 6,000 hours, are recorded. And 35 and a half years, essentially under one leadership. That may be a record for duration of a net of any kind under one group of people. Let me drop it. The TechNet itself, the last 10 or 11 years of them are all recorded. You go to a website, which is amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateur radio, all spelled out together with no punctuation. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and 4 hours worth of TechNet will be played back to you. Another TechNet, another website, run by Mike KC2, no, that's Mike number one, KC2NJI with the amateurradio.tv. Mike number two is K1MJM. He runs another TechNet website, which is called MyMarkTechNet.com. MyMarkTechNet.com. There you'll find additional material aiding the TechNet, articles, graphs, pictures, and so on, of what this particular antenna you're listening to, what it looks like. Let me drop. And don't worry about whether or not your question is too simple for the TechNet, or you think the question is too dumb. There's no such thing as a dumb question. That's not our philosophy of the TechNet. A so-called dumb question represents the biggest difference between what the guy knows and what he would like to know. Therefore, that's the one most deserving of an answer. That's our philosophy. We don't worry about whether or not the question is worthy enough, comes up to our level. Sometimes the TechNet gets pretty deep into some subjects, and sometimes it's pretty light. You sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment, and try to remember in between each transmission to wait for the three beeps, meaning the machine has been thoroughly reset, so that the IRLP and the can't even think of the names of those things. There's various things connected to the TechNet by which people can listen to it and sign into it from out of the area. This particular repeater has good coverage of the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. But for people who are outside of that area, quite a few of them are listening, and sometimes they sign in. For instance, we quite often get some very good questions from the Golden Horseshoe area near Toronto, Canada, among other places. Let me drop. By Echolink is what I was trying to think of. Echolink, IRLP. There's a chat room also associated with the TechNet. And Roy monitors that, AC2GS. Okay, so at this time we're going to take check-ins. You're going to give me your call letters, your name, the word yes, and you're going to wait for the beeps in between each transmission. G2RIW listening.
Nova 2, Hotel Victor Radio. Yes.
I heard November 2, Hotel Victor Radio. Please repeat your name, sir.
The name here is Nick, and yes, I have a question.
Okay. You said your name, but maybe it's because of the noise. I didn't get it. You may have to spell it out phonetically. Hotel Victor Radio, please tell me your name.
Yeah, the name here is Nick, November Indian Charlie Kilo. Yes.
Very fine, Nick. Okay, we've got Nick. Anyone else is signing? Give me a call letters and name right now.
82-HUC, Steve, and yes.
Very good, we got you, Steve. So far we got Nick and Steve. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WB2QEQ, Glenn, just listening. No questions.
Okay, Glenn. One last call. Anyone to sign in with questions or comments for the TechNet tonight? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
W2AXZ in Brooklyn. I'll be answering a few questions from Andy and a few others. WA2AXZ.
So I'm with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Good evening, Paul and AXZ. We got you. You didn't give us your name. I think it's Bob. Is that true, Mr. AXZ?
Yeah, Bob or Lobie. Yeah, don't call me late for dinner. Lobie is good enough.
Very fine, Bob or Lobie. Okay, we're going to start off with Nick. Nick, you're number one on the runway tonight. November 2, Hotel Victor Radio, K2RIW. Go ahead with your question, Nick.
All right, good evening, Jake, and everyone on the net. My question is, I'm setting up an HF station for 40 meters, and I'm using an antenna tuner. I only have, I'm using an N-fed wire, so I have like about 20 feet of wire outside my condo between two insulators. I've grounded one end, and I'm N-feeding it with a tuner. I'm able to tune to 40 meters, not a problem. My question is, well, I'm having trouble tuning the other bands because the tuner is not really that great. But the other thing is, I was told by some technical people I'm going to install a 4-to-1 ballum. So I'm going to feed a 50 ohm coax from the transmitter, from the tuner, out to the ballum. It will be outside. 50 ohm, coax cable, SL239 connectors. And then one side of the ballum will feed the end of my wire. The other side of the ballum goes directly to ground, and I'm thinking of even adding some ground radials. I was just wondering what your opinion on a setup like that. Does that sound to you or not? That's really my question. Back to you, Dick. This is N2HVR.
Okay, Nick, I think I've got the picture of what you're trying to do. You have a limited amount of space. Under ordinary circumstances, an antenna for the 40-meter band, if it's 40 meters, one of the bands you have the greatest interest, would often constructed by guys as a dipole-like antenna, roughly 67 feet long. I think you said your antenna is 20 feet long between two insulators outside of your apartment. And,
back to that, do you copy me?
Okay, Nick, are you adding some additional information? Go ahead, Nick.
No, I mean, did you get that transmission? I just wanted to know, what do you think about adding a 4-to-1 ballum? It's a 4-to-1 ballum, which I was told would help me tune to some of the higher. I'm tuning 40 meters without a ballum. Just a tuner feeding an N-fed wire between two insulators and the ground. And I'm able to tune 40 meters with a very low SWR at 100 watts. But I can't tune the other bands, and someone was telling me that if I had a 4-to-1 band, I should be able to tune the higher bands, like 20 meters and 10 meters. So I was just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, that is the question I was going to answer, but I was going to first give you some background information. In the old days, people used to think that the antenna itself had to be resonant, properly tuned, get the right impedance at the particular frequencies you want to operate on. That was the old days. The antenna itself had to be a complete device presenting a good impedance at each of the bands you care about. Nowadays, by way of an antenna tuner that's got wide enough tuning range, you can take almost any length of wire, grounded or ungrounded, close to the ground, far away from the ground, with or without a ballon. By the way, ballon is B-A-L-U-N, N for Nancy, not M for Mike. N for Nancy is ballon. That's a contraction of balanced and unbalanced. Many people mispronounce it, and I think you might be mispronouncing it, Nick. In order for an antenna to radiate, the antenna system, the radiating, what you call the radiating system, must hit resonance. Resonance means that the signal you send into it is going to bounce back and forth, usually 10 or more times, before it finally gets radiated. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 10 times before it finally gets radiated. Resonance means that each of the bounces back and forth on your system in phase with each other, and the current gets multiplied by roughly 10 to 1. The higher the 10 to 1 current creates a stronger magnetic field, and that starts the radiation process. So radiation resonance is the most important thing about an antenna. The balun, a properly installed balun on a particular antenna on a particular band, can give you a better impedance match. And by the way, what impedance you're going to see, as long as you know the length of the wire and roughly the diameter of the wire, there's a set of curves that will tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get, the resistive component and the reactive component, the so-called Brown and...
Repeater, timeout.
I just timed out the machine. The so-called Brown and Woodward curves. If you go to those two websites, amateurradio.tangovictor or limontechnet.com, in either case you'll see a set of curves, Brown and Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, way back in 1945, took various lengths of wire and really measured what impedance you're going to see. So you can predict ahead of time what impedance your particular length of wire is going to give you. And whether or not you ground the far end or don't ground the far end are one of the choices you can make. But the impedance you're going to get can be predicted. Therefore, if for instance, the impedance turned out to be 4 times 50 ohms, and you used a 4 to 1 balun, yes, you would make a much better impedance match. You might not need the 4 to 1 balun if you've got a large enough tuning range of your particular antenna tuner. So you can predict the impedance ahead of time at each one of the frequencies on each one of the bands. Let me drop it. The most extreme case of this new concept of antennas. Remember the cell phones you used to use in the old days? You used to have a whip antenna. You would an expandable whip antenna sticking out of the top. And all of our cell phones these days don't have an external antenna anymore. There's a tiny little device inside called antenna, which does not tune to each of those frequencies. Right alongside of that antenna is an integrated circuit chip, which really is an antenna tuner that forces that antenna inside your cell phone to resonate on each one of those frequencies. Therefore, it radiates, if you know what I mean. So making a good impedance match, your antenna tuner can do it. The balun can aid that process. And so I don't have an exact answer for all of the bands you want to operate on with your 20-foot long piece of wire. And by the way, wire is a very low visibility device. Usually you can have more than one wire, even at an apartment building. Some of them inside the house, some of them outside. Various guys will put up various pieces of wire and feed the right one at the right time. So what impedance you're going to get and whether or not you'll make an improvement with the balun can be predicted by the Brown and Woodward curves. And it takes a little bit of introduction to understand what you're looking at when you look at those curves. Let me drop. The Brown and Woodward curves are for a monopole-like antenna. In other words, one piece of wire against ground, which really is your case, so to speak. And for people who want to use it for a dipole really is a pair of monopoles back-to-back. There's a monopole to the right and a monopole to the left, with a neutral plane in the middle, so to speak, where you feed it in the case of a dipole. So if you're trying to predict the impedance of a dipole, you take the numbers you get off the Brown and Woodward curves and double them, because it's really giving you one half of a dipole. But in your case, a monopole-like antenna is feeding one end. And you can predict the impedance and therefore find out on each one of the bands what's the reactive component going to be, which you could decide to cancel it if you want to, by making an L network, for instance, you know, an inductor and a capacitor just right, or use it as is with the balun. So I haven't given you an exact answer to your question, but I've told you the recipe as to how you can find an answer. And whether or not, let me drop a quick. Whether or not you get the complete answer by this particular approach is a function of how much homework you do, Nick. And you're allowed to come back in future weeks, ask the question again, saying that I did this, I added a 9-to-1 balun, and I went from this condition to that condition. The Brown and Woodward curves predicted I would get such and such. So you're allowed to come back with further questions on this. So, as I said, I've given you a recipe for how to solve the antenna problem on zillions of kinds of antennas. But I'll admit you haven't gotten an exact answer to this particular question. In case there's somebody out there listening to us who has a better, more distinct answer for your particular question, drag your feet a little bit. Let's see if anyone else wants to sign in and add anything to this. So we're going to pass it back to Nick into Victor Radio with a delay to see if anyone else wants to give us their call letters and name, because they've got information along these lines they want to add to this. And to HVR to take it with a delay, K2LIW in the TechNet. Looks like nobody's got anything to add at this time, my Nick. Go right ahead, Nick.
82AMZ with a comment.
Okay, you know, I mean, I didn't expect an exact answer, but I just wanted to know that I'm doing it. I will look at those charts, and I actually did increase the wire size. I had a very thin wire, and I increased it to a thicker wire, you know, and insulators in the ground. I'm adding radio. I have a ground rod in the ground, you know, a piece of copper tubing embedded in the ground, a heavy wire from that to the antenna. I'm going to add maybe some ground radials, you know, but I haven't done the balun yet. That's something I'm going to add. It's funny, though, even with a cheap tuner, and I have now a more expensive tuner, I tune 40 meters with that wire with no problem. I can tune the whole band on 40, and I get an SWR like 1.2 to 1. It works great. I can actually tune 30 meters also, like 10, you know, 10 megs, but only for CW. But the other bands won't really tune to a decent. So that's why I'm hoping the band will do well. I'm going to try it, and I will get back to the net if it hopefully works out, you know, by adding the balun and a good piece of coax between the antenna tuner and the balun. All right, back to that. Thank you, Dick, and this is N2HVR. Back to that.
82AMZ with a comment.
Yeah, that's Mike, 82AMZ, who's going to give us some further information on this. Once again, Nick, the device you're calling balun, B-A-L-U-M, is really B-A-L-U-N. B-A-L-U-N for Nancy. People will sometimes make fun of you for pronouncing the balun the other way. It's B-A-L-U-N for Nancy, balun. Stands for a contraction of balance to unbalance. Go ahead, Mike, with your information on Nick's question. KD2AMZ. K2RIW, you got a mic.
KD2AMZ. Nick, I've had great success. When I was stationed down in Virginia, I was in a small apartment building, three-story, to my particular case, and I energized the building's gutter system. But the most important thing which worked, I've tried balun's, 9-to-1, 4-to-1's, I've tried various experiments. What worked the best was a remote tuner. Not a regular tuner, but you want to put a remote tuner at the base of whatever you're going to call your radiator. In my case, it was a building gutter system. Because that way, you maintain your impedance match from your transmitter through the coax to the tuner, and you're actually tuning at the antenna, so you're taking the coax out of the equation. And all I did was drive a ground rod in from my counterpoise and the hot lead to the building's gutter system, and it worked quite well on pretty much all bands from 160 all the way up through, I don't know, it started fizzling out around 10 meters. Something you might want to consider is a remote tuner. Dick, any comments on a remote?
Yeah, thank you, Mike. You're, without a doubt, the remote tuner, if you've got one with wide enough tuning range, it's the more Cadillac approach to tune right at the antenna even before you enter the transmission line on the way down, if you know what I mean. The remote tuners are a little bit pricey, and whether or not they've got enough tuning range is something to worry about. The advantage of putting the antenna tuner remotely is that now the transmission line going from the shack to the antenna system is matched all the way and gives you minimum loss. As long as your transmission line is short enough, and as long as it's low enough in loss, like open wire line, putting the antenna tuner in the shack does not give you a disadvantage if the transmission line is short enough and low enough in loss. You can do the tuning anywhere in the system as long as the you're not getting extra loss. When you operate a transmission line at very high standing wave ratio, like you might do with a very poorly tuned antenna and you're doing all the bow ending and matching in the shack, you could be running your transmission line at a very high standing wave ratio, which means the signal bouncing back and forth is now bouncing back and forth in the transmission line. And the transmission line can give you a lot of excess loss. A piece of RG58, for instance, might only have an insertion loss for your particular band, for your particular length of only a dB or so. Because you're running it at an extremely high VISWAR, you can get 10 or 20 dB of extra loss in that transmission line if the tuner is in the shack. So, as I said, it's the Cadillac approach, but if your transmission line is short enough, as it is, I think, in Nick's case, where I don't think you've got a very long line between the apartment building and the antenna. So, you could continue using the bounding device and the antenna tuner.
Repeater, timeout.
You could continue using those devices in the shack. By the way, I didn't wait for the same for the four beeps. Stand by. You got to reset the machine, otherwise we'll be timing it out. So you can see why I call it the Cadillac approach, the slightly more expensive approach, the more elegant approach, the remote antenna tuner. It's not always required. I wonder if that makes a little bit more sense, Nick. N2HVR, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KD2MZ for follow-up.
Yeah, stand by, Nick. Go ahead, Mike, and give us your additional info, and wait for the beep.
You don't necessarily have to buy a remote tuner. You can buy a cheap MFJ auto tuner, and you can configure it to auto-tune. And all you got to do is throw a CW signal on it, and it'll start the tuning process. I have used cheap MFJ auto tuners, which are meant to be used indoors, as a remote tuner, and it worked quite well. If you follow what I'm trying to say, so you can use a cheap auto tuner as a remote tuner. The only catch might be you got to fly. I don't know, like a battery voltage, a 12 volts or something at it, which is really no big deal. Back to net.
Mike, when you use that so-called cheap auto tuner, which is intended for indoor service, and you use it as a remote antenna tuner out in the weather, what did you do to weatherproof it, Mike? Go ahead.
Actually, I used an old Sears toolbox. It worked extremely well. We've actually used that tuner setup when we were at the Cradle of Aviation Museum and such. But it sits on an old plastic Sears toolbox. It worked quite well.
Katie, to clarify you with a comment.
Okay, go ahead with your comment, George. Wait for the beeps.
I think a key thing that was said about Nick's trouble is that he is able to tune on one band and not able to tune on another. And something is really coming back at that tuner to disable its capacity, to disable its ability to do it, its range to do it. Let me run it. I look at the fact that he's saying he has an N-wire system. Is the N-wire system a balanced system or an un-in system? If it's an un-in system, it's utilizing the cable, the feed line cable, to help with the alternate phase of current. And that's really ripping into his tuner and his shack. And he's not able to get other bands. And that's the key that we got to look at right here. That will determine what type of balance or un-in he's going to have where the feed is going into that end wire. Is it truly an un-in system or is it a balance system? Balance system could be 4-to-1, 2-to-1, 1-to-1, whatever. But he's really got to run it off to an un-in and utilize what's coming back on that feed, on that cable, for part of, or a good part of the alternate phase then he's got to choke it off in the front of that tuner in his shack, not at the feed point from the feed line to the end fed wire. Did I get that clear, Dick?
Reasonably clear, George. Part of what's going on here, there's an infinite number of ways of feeding your particular antenna system. A set of counterpoise ground plane radials near the antenna is one approach. If there's a nearby grounding system, it might be the steel structure of the building itself, a nearby ground that you connect the shield to at the end of the cable, and the center conductor goes to the radiator itself. That's one approach. Whether or not you set up another piece of wire connected to the shield of the cable at the end, and it really is a kind of a dipole. And by the way, a dipole doesn't have to have the two wires collinear with each other. They don't have to be 180 degrees between them. They can be almost any other degrees. The wire itself that does the radiating, the wire that does the counterpoising, doesn't have to be straight. It can be zigzagged. It can have chokes in it. There's a lot of different ways of doing this. Let me drop. And one other crazy thing that's going on here is that even if the impedance at the end of the transmission line, I'd say for instance 20 meters, he's got an antenna that works well on 40, but maybe on 20 meters it works rather poorly because it's got a very high visor at the far end, and therefore whatever transmission line he's using is running at a certain number of wavelengths of transmission line with a crazy impedance at the far end. The nice thing about a piece of 50 ohm cable, for instance, is that at the far end is a 50 ohm resistor, as an impedance, the antenna, then the transmission line will look like 50 ohms for any length. If the transmission line is looking into any other impedance besides a 50 ohm resistor, then it is doing a impedance conversion process. If the antenna, for instance, happened to be 25 ohms resistance, and if the transmission line happens to be an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, then you'll see that, by the way, a 25 ohm impedance is a 2-to-1. In the shack, you will see a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, but you wouldn't see 25 ohms, you'll see 100 ohms, which is another way of getting 2-to-1. I'm just using that as an example. Transmission line will convert impedance. The reason that's important, let me drop, is that if this is the best of all worlds, your antenna tuner manufacturer would supply you a Smith chart. The Smith chart is a chart that shows impedances, every possible impedance in the world, high and low resistance, high and low reactance, plus and minus, is a dot somewhere on that Smith chart. If your antenna tuner manufacturer had really done his job, he'd present to you a Smith chart where he would color in the portion of the chart that the impedances can be matched with that antenna tuner, so that even if your particular antenna is an impedance dot on that chart, which is outside of the colored region for your particular antenna tuner, if you add the right length of transmission line, add or subtract transmission line, that will rotate that dot of yours with the same visor to some other part in the chart where now it's the colored in section. So the point I'm making here is that in many a case, your antenna tuner might run out of range for your particular antenna system, and if you add the right length of transmission lines, exact same transmission lines, to it, it rotates your impedance into a more favorable section where the antenna tuner can take it. As you can see, there's a lot of different solutions to this one. You're probably going to have some further questions on further weeks, and we understand that, Nick. We know we're hitting you with a lot of info in a hurry. N2HVR, K2RIW for any follow-up questions or any fills. You've got it, Nick.
All right, Dick. Yeah, there's a lot of information, but I understand most of it. And I thought about a remote tuner. I was actually going to go that way, but I did not want to have... I didn't feel I needed it because I didn't want the tuner outside the house, outside the condo. I really can't have all this stuff hanging outside. The other thing was I have a very short transmission line. Between the radio right now and where my antenna is located is less than 40 feet. I'm using a decent piece of coax, RG8X. So I'm thinking I haven't added the bound. I have a 4-in-1 bound right here in the shack, and I
I'm going to install it the next few days, so I'm hoping that that'll help. But that's where I'm going to try all that and, you know, experiment with it, but hopefully if I have some better... I'm not going to change the laws of physics. I don't expect to go to 80 in any reality, but I do get 40 pretty well with what I have now. I'm hoping to work at least 20 and maybe 20, 15, and 10. And if I can do that, I'd be very happy, you know. The lower bands, lower than 40, I don't ever believe I'm going to be able to do, and I don't expect to. I'm not going to, any tune is not going to change the laws of physics. So anyway, thank you for all the info. This is Nick, N2HVR, back to Ned.
Have a quick design help.
There's at least one other thing you can do here, Nick. Buy or borrow from one of your friends or one of your ham radio operator clubs or whatever an antenna analyzer. By way of an antenna analyzer, which is a normal handy tool to have, you might want to decide to go out and buy one. You can measure the impedance of your system by using the antenna analyzer remotely right at the antenna itself, but in the shack. By way of an antenna analyzer, a good antenna analyzer will tell you exactly what the resistive component and what the reactive component is in the shack going into your piece of RG8X. That tells you what to do. And once you know the exact impedance your antenna is presenting, you can calculate it by way of the Brown and Woodward curve, and in your case, the I think it's a 20 or 40 feet of coax cable is giving you an additional impedance reaction. It's changing the impedance of the antenna to something slightly different by the time it gets into the shack. But you can calculate that ahead of time, or you can really measure it with an antenna tuner. Once you've got an antenna tuner, it tells you exactly what to do. Even if you run out of range of your particular antenna tuner in the shack, let me drop. When you know what that impedance is, you can very easily add a choke or a capacitor or a L network, and a choke and a capacitor of the right value. Then you wind the choke yourself on a piece of PVC tubing, you know, X number of microhenries with a transmitter grade capacitor will now convert that crazy impedance in the shack to something that's within the range of the antenna tuner. Or if you take it all the way, it'll do a perfect impedance match all the way. So with an antenna analyzer, you can find out exactly what you've got on each one of your bands. So if some of your friends have an antenna analyzer, that's an awful handy thing to do. I think George had an additional piece of information. I think it was George. Over to you, George, if that was you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, the design would be, if he's running an N-fed wire like that, of course he wants it to be a random length, whether it's 24, 31, 44, 55, whatever, 77. He wants to put a 9-to-1 unin at the feed point. The coax coming back is going to be a random length that is not the same length as the wire, more than 44 feet for the coax, no matter what the length of the random wire is. At that point, when he has the unin 9-to-1 at the feed point, running the coax back, he now has a choke of maybe, 18, 20 turns, 4 to 5 inches concentrically in front of where his station is coming in. So he's not letting the resonance on the feed line come into the station equipment. Right there, he now has a very, very tunable, small type of N-fed antenna. KD2FIU. And M2PO.
As you can tell, Nick, there's a lot of different ways of doing it. And knowing what the impedance is by way of an antenna analyzer will give you some further information. However, if you follow George's advice and Mike's advice, and do all of these experiments. Some of those experiments will work well and some of them will not work so well in your particular case. And your transmitter, a modern day transmitter, is quite rugged. It's not going to explode if you do something wrong, if you know what I mean. So you try all of these things and find out which ones work and how well they work. Rich N2EO has got some further information for you, because I think he's hooked up antennas a little bit like this. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
In my opinion, we brought this up before, of open wire line or just swim lanes as opposed to coax. Because coax, I found, on a non-resonant antenna, is very awesome.
Yeah, it turns out that Rich is running open wire line, 450 ohm open wire line, ladder line as it's called, to his particular antenna. Nice thing about ladder line is that no matter how high the standing wave ratio is, it almost doesn't matter. The ladder line is so low in loss that the additional loss doesn't count, if you know what I mean. So that's another way to go. Okay, we're going to leave that with you, Nick, and you're going to come back next week with some further questions. You're going to you've got some homework to do, but I hope you're able to get a hold of an antenna analyzer from somebody, from a friend or whatever. That will help. But even without that, trying all of these approaches, some of them are going to work better than others, and you'll eventually settle on an antenna system you're happy with. The next person on the list was Steve, KD2HUC. Go right ahead, Steve, with your question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Dick. My question tonight is in regards to something stupid that I did earlier today. I was tuning up to operate on 20 meters, like I do on most Sundays, and my antenna, the standing wave ratio of my antenna at 20 meters is usually around like 2.1 to 1. Let me let it drop. And I was tuning up my AL-80A, and I always start at 5 watts of drive, and, you know, I peaked everything out and everything looked good. And so then I went to 30 watts of drive, and I let the smoke out. All of a sudden I got a little poof out of the vent fan, and, you know, that odor that we all know and love. So I killed it, and I put it on the bench, and I opened it up, and I cannot find a single thing that could that failed. There's no burn, no marks, even sniffing around all the components, not even a trace of that odor. I'm at a loss, and I wanted to know if you guys have any ideas on where I could start looking at this thing, because everything looks healthy. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, that's a tough one. By way of your external metering, maybe you've got a bird watt meter or whatever, and you put it into a dummy load. Does the rig put out any power at all when you try to transmit with it now? And tell us once again what the rig is in this particular case, Steve. KD2HUC, wait for the four beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it's an Ameritron AL-80A amplifier. It's a single 3500Z tube. I've been running it now for about a year, no problems. It was, let's see, when I got the poof, it was, I had 30 watts of drive and I was outputting probably about 400 or so watts into the antenna. I have not fired it up since. It's actually in pieces. I broke it all down to investigate. It's actually sitting in pieces in front of me on the bench. And I was interested to know, if you know what I mean, like, maybe I tuned up on a harmonic inadvertently. I mean, what do you think?
Okay, that's a tube-type amplifier. If it was a solid-state amplifier, troubleshooting can be very difficult. If I understand you correctly, that Ameritron is a tube-type amplifier. It put out some smoke and engaged some smells you don't like. But even though you've got it apart, if you very carefully feed it into a dummy load and measure power output, slowly sneak up on it by putting some drive into it, does it put out any power at all? And if you're very carefully operating it with the case off, be careful of the high voltages, that may give you some further clues. Right right now you'd like to know where it used to put out 400 watts. Is it only putting out 40 watts right now? Or when it puts out 400 watts, does something run hot when you're doing that? Like maybe switch contacts, you know, for the band selecting are not doing the job correctly. So you're one of the ways of doing some troubleshooting would be to slowly sneak up onto it and see what power output it puts into a dummy load. Over to you, Steve. KD2HUC, wait for the beeps. K2LIW.
K2 eject.
Eric, I go right ahead.
Assuming it's in a minute time, and I think he said it was a 3500 or 4500. Then he's got to have plate current and plate voltage meters. If you operate and everything was working fine, you get a good sense of where it is. And if you're into something that's non-resonance, you're going to see something way different as far as the meters go.
Yeah, but if he's putting it into a 50-ohm tummy load and measuring power output and watching those meters, that is the next step of troubleshooting is one particular approach. See if you agree with that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, I absolutely agree, but you can, right off the bat, before you even stick it into a dummy load, you can see if you have an issue that's sort of outside the transmitter or inside the transmitter. With most good tube transmitters, you get to see what kind of drive you're putting into it and what the plate current is based upon the given voltage that you're using on the plate. It gives you clues, but ultimately, sticking it into a load, you don't really have to worry about tuning it up too badly. It is a tube transmitter, so you're still going to make the thing resonant on whatever frequency is going on. So, but ultimately, that's the best way to tell what's going on.
Steve, what was your plate current measuring and plate voltage and things like this after the smoke was let out? Did the meters read something differently? Standby current, drive, and when you drive it to bias current, if you know what I mean. What were the meters reading when the smoke came out, after the smoke came out? What was different than the meter readings? KD2HUC, K2LIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Nothing, Dick. The plate voltage is on or about 3 kilovolts. The plate current was about 200 mils. And I do not know what the grid current was because, unfortunately, the grid current meter on this amplifier doesn't work. Now that I have it apart, I will most likely put forth the effort to repair that as well. So I can't tell you what the grid current is. I can only tell you that the plate current was normal. I did not see any peaks or spikes or anything of that nature.
Steve, do you have any way of knowing what power output it's giving you now? Like, the possibility exists that your particular high standing wave ratio arced over the plate tuning capacitor, so to speak, and there's nothing for you to see now. So, do you have any reason to believe it is not putting out power at this time? And by the way, if it's internal metering telling you power output, you could have had a failure with the metering. So, an external Bird watt meter would also be great. So, do you have any way of knowing what RF power output you're getting now after the smoke test? Back to you, Steve.
I do not, Dick, because I did not power it up again afterwards. I was afraid that, you know, I may do additional damage, you know, until what the cause was. So I broke it apart, and before I powered it back up, I wanted to get your guys' takes on it, you know, because I certainly don't want to do anything that could, A, risk damaging the tube that's brand new, or any other components. You know, a lot of components in the amp are new from, you know, when I got it a year or so ago.
Yeah, I can see your feeling on that. The tube is the most valuable part of that, or the plate transformer for the plate voltage. In order to destroy a tube like that, which is a very rugged tube, you'd have to do something pretty weird, like running it key down for 10 solid seconds, so to speak, with an extremely mistuned plate circuit, where now the tube is dissipating all kinds of extra power and the plate is glowing red. That tube is pretty rugged, so on brief transmissions, to find the power output on your various bands would be an an interesting test, and I don't think it can create further damage. But I'm going to ask you, Eric, for comment on that. As long as he's making brief transmissions, with or without resonance, and he's tuning it, and he's looking at power output with a Bird watt meter into a dummy load or his real antenna, I think that amplifier is not that delicate. That's my thinking on that one. KE2EJ, K2RIW, what do you think, Eric?
2RIW, KE2EJ. I'm not sure how this conversation began, what I'm gathering is that smoke came out of the amplifier, and what exactly tube is it? I'll tell you what I've done in the past with like 3 and 10 kilowatt transmitters, when I run into unknowns like that, although I usually do have better metering than what he's talking about. It's not being able to read the grid currents is a big missing clue. But when I get into something weird, I actually take the tube out of the socket, okay? I power the thing up and check voltages and see how things are under no-load conditions. I don't usually turn the high voltage on. I don't do that until last anyway. But if there's anything that's like a resistor burned up, and typically what happens is, like any tetra transmitters, you've got these bypass capacitors that are actually made out of sheets of Teflon, because we're talking high power here. And they have a tendency to short out, and they can make a real mess. So, but that's with a tetrode. I don't know whether you've got a tetrode or a ground or a grid that's running ground as a grid. When it actually comes to powering up the tube, I'll need a drop. You do it in short bursts. I mean, if you're way out of resonance, actually, we'll use something like a grid dip meter, or I happen to have my little portable VNA. I'll stick it into the circuit and then get roughly close to where I need to be, especially if we've moved the transmitter and frequency, but generally you don't have to do that. If you're smart, you keep a little record of where your tuning is for any particular band or any particular group of frequencies, so you can always get close. 5 seconds, 10 seconds, completely, you know, with a load that looks like a short or completely open, you're not going to do anything bad to the tube. So I really don't have a problem with, you know, keying up for a short period of time and you know, doing the plate tuning and finding the nice spot for that, and then maybe take a break and then do an antenna loading. And then when you really get close, when you're starting to draw a real plate current in the right direction, you don't have to worry about it.
Now, I've got a further question for you on this one, Eric. No matter which tube he's got, I'm assuming this is probably a grounded grid, cathode-driven, linear amplifier of that particular tube. And as long as the plate voltage is present and the plate is drawing normal current, putting a normal amount of drive into that tube is not going to do anything bad. The worst-case condition I can believe, where he doesn't have a grid current meter, which he's about to fix, the worst condition I can think of is applying drive to that cathode of that grounded grid tube with no plate voltage to draw all that extra current off, in which case now your drive becomes a tremendous amount of grid current and you can do damage to that grid. As long as the plate voltage is there and the plate is drawing some reasonable amount of current, then that grid is being protected. That's my belief on that one. Give me some further information on this one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech van.
Now, in the words of K2RIW, give that man a cigar. With the tech van, it's a little bit of a different issue. I don't power up the tube without plate current, plate voltage. So I can do it with a tetrode as long as I know that my tetrode current is there. And besides, it's a different configuration, so what you can do to the tube is a lot different as opposed to a grounded grid, which all of a sudden your grounded grid becomes a nice conductor and that thing really doesn't want to draw to handle much current. I mean, most of the big tubes that I deal with, the maximum current allowed on the control grid is something like less than 100 milliamps. When you're talking about tetrodes, then, you know, tetrode current can be, on a 3 kilowatt tube, something like 450 mils, 500 mils, 600 mils in that neighborhood. Even to draw that much is kind of hard to do. And without plate voltage, you're not doing anything bad because that that grid is temporarily acting like a plate, and it's a lot happier than the control grid.
Yeah, in the case of a tetro tube with no plate voltage, your screen grid is now acting like a plate. You got to be careful you don't increase that current too much. Tell us once again, what is the tube that's in your amplifier, Steve? KD2HUC, K2LIW.
It is a 3500Z Dick, and it is in a grounded grid configuration. Also, to answer your other question, during this event, I did not hear anything whatsoever. The amp was very quiet, no hissing, nothing abnormal, and nothing to indicate any arcing or anything. KD2HUC, back to net.
One of the things I don't know about this amplifier is where is the power supply, and was the smell you were smelling coming from the power supply section and not the amplifier? Over to you on that one, Steve. Wait for the beeps, I didn't.
The power supply in the, the RF and all are under one chassis. Now, you bring up a good point, and I was actually able to eliminate the possibility of the issue being at the input tuning stage because of the way the cooling fan is installed. Let me let it drop. Basically, there's a partition that runs down the middle of the amplifier. The power supply, including the rectifier boards and the filter capacitors, are on the left side, and then the RF with the tube is on the right side. The fan draws air in on the left and pressurizes the chamber with the tube in it, and of course there's an exhaust port right in front of the tube. If there was anything with the inductors as part of the internal tuning, the input tuning, I don't think the smoke would have came out of the fan because I believe that airflow would actually come out from the front of the amplifier. If you follow what I'm saying, the airflow wouldn't go in that direction. KD2HUC, back to net.
I have a suggestion.
Yeah, let me go back to Eric first. Eric, now that we know it's a triode tube and the power supply is in the same cabinet with the amplifier itself, as long as the plate voltage is there and the plate current is something normal, therefore the drive is not all going into the control grid and exceeding control grid current. What I'm worried about here is where he doesn't have a control grid current meter. That's the one thing he can do to the tube that could do it some damage after a period of time, a few seconds of key down with no plate voltage and lots of drive on the cathode. You can exceed grid current and not know about it and possibly damage the tube. But as long as he's got real plate current, I think he's a lot safer to do further experimenting, and Eric's going to give us some further words on this now that we know it's a grounded grid triode. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
KE2LIW, KE2EJ. Well, I have a couple of suggestions. First of all, of course, you take all covers off and physically inspect it. My way of thinking is take the tube out of the stock and put it aside for the moment. You can actually safely feed some, don't turn the high voltage on, feed some drive into it, make sure it's getting to the cathode pins. Fix your grid current meter so that way you know what's going on when you finally do put the tube back in. Take a really close look at the band switches on that amplifier. I believe they're made out of this kind of phenolic material, and over time, you start to become a little bit conductive, and you'll see it gets black, and he didn't describe the smell of the smoke, so that's sometimes a big clue. The other thing I would suggest you do is look at the rectifier board, where you have all those rectifiers and capacitors across them. Take a really close look at them. Chances are, although you say you didn't hear anything, arcs don't necessarily have to make sound that you're going to pick up. Take a look physically at everything before you go any further. And then, even before you put the tube in, if you don't happen to have one, borrow a high voltage probe and measure the actual voltage to see what's there. K2IW, K2J.
Comment, WA2AXZ.
I think he's got metering. He knows that the voltage is there. Bob? Mr. AXZ, go right ahead, Bob, with your suggestion, K2LIW.
He did say he never turned it on after the smoke.